I'm Judy Young. I'm one of the co-authors of a book titled Island Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island.
Sorry, he wants to start again.
I'm Judy Young. I'm one of the co-authors of Island Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island, 1910 to 1940. I'm going to be reading three poems from a collection of 135 poems that were found carved in the walls of the Angel Island Immigration Station. The first poem is from the section called The Voyage.
Can you push the mic away just a little bit? Like that?
How's that? Is that better?
Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers.
Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers.
Are you getting peas? Really? Because I'm not hearing peas at all. Really? Okay. He says to push it away just a little bit more.
Is that better?
Peter Piper.
Peter Piper. Random thoughts deep at night.
No, we want peas.
Oh, peas. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
I'm not hearing him. Okay. Well, he said from the top. I'm sorry, Judy.
Back to the beginning? Oh, okay. This is just like doing...
like doing film, huh?
Film. Okay. This is Judy Young. I'm one of the co-authors of a book titled Island, Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island, 1910 to 1940. I'm going to read three poems from a collection of 135 Chinese poems that were carved in the walls of the Angel Island Immigration Station. The first poem is from the section titled The Voyage. And in Cantonese, this is what it says. The title, Sam Ye Ngao Gam, Ye Jing Mei Meng, Feng Xiu Sing, Ying Ying Xiong Ting, Gin Ging Wing, Wan Mo San San Yang Am Tin, Chong Sing Jik Jik Yu Mei Meng, Bei Fu Xiong Lin, Tin Xiong Hin, Cao Yan Dok Cho, Yi Chong Bin. And in English, random thoughts deep at night. In the quiet of night, I heard faintly the whistling of wind. The forms and shadows saddened me. Upon seeing the landscape, I composed a poem. The floating clouds, the fog, darkened the sky. The moon shines faintly as the insects chirp. Grief and bitterness entwined are heaven sent. The sad person sits alone, leaning by a window.
Can you do another take of both, of the Chinese and the English?
Sam ye ngao gam, ye jing mei men, feng xiu sing, ying ying xiong ting, gin ging wing, wan mo san san yang am tin, chong sing jik jik yu mei ming, bei fu xiong lin, tin xiong hin, sao yan, dok cho, Yi Chong Bin. And in English, random thoughts deep at night. In the quiet of night, I heard faintly the whistling of wind. The forms and shadows saddened me. Upon seeing the landscape, I composed a poem. The floating clouds, the fog, darkened the sky. The moon shines faintly as the insects chirp. Grief and bitterness entwined are heaven sent. The sad person sits alone, leaning by a window.
Are you hearing a rumble of any kind, Michael?
Maybe it's my stomach.
No. It's like a ventilation thing. Do you hear that at all? Because if you don't hear it, that's fine. But I'm hearing it just in here. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm not gonna worry then. I just had a question about that. Mm-hmm. What you read?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any clue as to what time period that was at all? That particular poem?
Most of them are written around the same time period because of the classical style in the 1930s, 20s, and 30s.
Okay. And is that a man or a woman?
all the poems in this collection we know were written by men because the poems by the women were in a building that was destroyed in the fire in 1940. So we have no records of poems by women.
Is that okay, Michael? All right. What does that poem say to you, what you just read?
Many of the poems, I think, reflect a sense of sadness, depression, loneliness, because these are immigrants that were being detained for weeks and months at a time. And they were just feeling very frustrated and depressed. And I think this poem kind of gives you that sense of loneliness and yearning to be freed or returned home.
Let's go ahead and go to another one.
Mm-hmm. The second poem is from a section actually called The Weak Shall Conquer. And these are poems that talk more about revenge and about wanting to get back at those who were mistreating the Chinese immigrants as they saw it during the exclusion period at Angel Island. Lao but choi kim do me chow, so ji do chi lo sung lao. Tong yok tak ji sing gong yat ding cham cho yan, cho but lao. Leaving behind my writing brush and removing my sword, I came to America. Who was to know two streams of tears would flow upon arriving here? If there comes a day when I shall have retained my ambition and become successful, I will certainly behead the barbarians and spare not a single blade of grass.
And what does that poem say to you?
And this is, I think, the people were very aware at Angel Island that they were being discriminated against because they were Chinese, and that they were unable to do anything about the situation. And so they also realized that it's because China was a weak country at this time among the nations in the world, and that's another reason why the Chinese were being looked down on and being discriminated against in the United States, unlike the Japanese, for example, at this time, who had still the right to immigrate and who were coming through Angel Island as well, but were not detained for long periods and excluded by law the same way that Chinese were. So the poems are trying to, I think, express a feeling that someday, you know, I'm going to get my revenge at being so mistreated.
You're saying the Japanese were allowed to?
Chinese immigrants were allowed until 1924. Well, the Gentlemen's Agreement in 1907, 1908 was the first law that tried to stop Japanese laborers from coming. But women could still come as picture brides until 1921. And then it was 1924 that the exclusion law against Japanese in particular, called the Immigration Act of 1924, was passed. But up to 1924, Japanese immigrants were just passing through Angel Island and allowed to land in San Francisco almost within a day, whereas the Chinese were detained for at least a few weeks, if not months at times, awaiting to be freed because they had to go through a special interrogation process to comply with the Chinese Exclusion Act.
I think at the beginning of that, you said the Chinese were able to come until 1924.
I did?
Yeah,
okay.
I think you did.
I meant to say, well, in 1907-08, the Gentlemen's Agreement was passed that stopped the further immigration of Japanese laborers, but women could still come from Japan as picture brides until 1921. And then in 1924, the Immigration Act of 1924 made it impossible for further immigration from Japan.
We know for sure these are all Cantonese, too. How do we know that?
Okay. Immigrants coming from China beginning in 1850 until World War II were coming from Guangdong province, and they speak Cantonese. And so the immigrants from China that were detained at Angel Island between 1910 and 1940, when the immigration station was in operation, were all Cantonese-speaking immigrants from Guangdong province. So we know that these poems were written by Cantonese-speaking immigrants in Chinese and read, and as I'm reading it now, it's in the Cantonese dialect that they would have used.
So when we interviewed, Charles, Do you remember the name of the doctor we interviewed? Oh, my gosh. Who was on the demo, and you said, you know.
Oh, Charles Choi Wong.
Okay.
The professor?
Yeah, the professor. Mm-hmm. He was reading in Mandarin. So, it was Charles.
That's a different person, yeah. It's not Wong, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't Wong.
Whoever it was.
But anyway, whoever he was, I can't remember. It was like a year ago. So when he's doing scholarly research, but he's doing it in Mandarin, does that make a difference?
Yeah, the sounds are different. I mean, the writing is the same, and probably the meaning is the same. But then many of the Chinese were not highly educated who wrote these poems, and they would use colloquial terms that are only, you know, used among the Guangdongese or Cantonese immigrants. So someone who doesn't know Cantonese would not be able to know what some of these words mean. And certainly when you read the poems, they sound completely different because even though it's the same writing, the pronunciation is completely different. And therefore, it throws off the rhyming schemes at times. So I think to be really true to the way that it was written by the people who wrote it is to hear it in Cantonese.
I would love to hear you continue reading. So anything else you want to read?
Okay, the last poem I want to read is a poem from a section called Deportees and Transients. And these were poems that were written by those who were passing through Angel Island on their way to another country or who were being deported through Angel Island. And this particular poem was written by someone who was leaving Mexico and staying at Angel Island until his boat was ready to take him back to China. It's one of the more deeply carved poems still visible today at Angel Island, and it's in two stanzas. The Chinese sounds like this. Mok ok koi lao ge sap tin so yan mak lai zi hin lin. Ho sik ying hong mo yong mo ji ting yam loi chak zhou bin. Chong gam yun bi qi lao zhong. Got wai hong guan zhong fun tong. Mok do ke gan gai sai sik. Detained in this wooden house for several tens of days, it is all because of the Mexican exclusion law which implicates me. It's a pity heroes have no way of exercising their prowess. I can only await the word so that I can snap Jew's whip. From now on, I am departing far from this building. All of my fellow villagers are rejoicing with me. Don't say that everything within is Western styled. Even if it is built of jade, it has turned into a cage.
Could you read it one more time and maybe a little bit slower?
Oh, okay. Both the just English?
Both.
Okay.
And push the mic just a little bit. This one's a little bit more away. There we go.
Okay.
A little bit more, he says.
Do you want one stanza at a time or the way I did it with two Chinese and then all the English?
Two Chinese?
Yeah, there's two stanzas, so I read
the
whole...
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, read one whole thing and then one whole thing.
Okay.
Just a little bit slower.
Mok ok koi lao ge sap tin, so yan mak lai zi hin lin, ho sik yang hong mo yong mo, ju ting yam loi chak zhou bin. Chong gam yun bi qi lao zhong, Got Wai Hong Guan Jong Fun Tong Mok Do Ke Gan Gai Sai Sik Chit Sing Yok Chai Bin Yu Long. Detained in this wooden house for several tens of days, it is all because of the Mexican exclusion law which implicates me. It's a pity heroes have no way of exercising their prowess. I can only await the word so that I can snap Jew's whip. From now on, I'm departing far from this building. All of my fellow villagers are rejoicing with me. Don't say that everything within is Western styled. Even if it is built of jade, it has turned into a cage.
That's interesting. It refers to two things stand out for me, the Mexican exclusion law.
Mm-hmm.
And is it Jew?
Jew's whip. It's a general.
A general?
A general Jew. It's... Many of the poems have historical references and allusions. So when we did the book, we made sure that we had the footnotes so people would know what these references
okay,
meant.
Go ahead and put the book down because I'm worried you're getting paper
okay.
sounds.
I was going to turn to the footnote to make sure. Oh. You want me to know what you want to know what Jew's whip is?
Yeah, what is that?
Okay.
Go ahead and turn.
Okay, wait. Okay.
Just go ahead and turn to it.
Okay. I can't hardly see. Okay, 58.
And I also want to hear more about the Mexican exclusion law, too.
Okay. You know, when we did this book, him, Mark Lai, the historian, and he had the best Chinese. He was the one that helped us with all the footnotes.
Ah.
Well, the Mexican exclusion law refers to, in Mexico, after the revolution, they actually had their version of the Chinese exclusion law that kept Chinese out of Mexico. So this particular poet evidently was being deported from Mexico because of that exclusion law. Jew's whip is a reference to this famous general who was during the Jin Dynasty in 265 A.D. His story is that, you know, when the northern invaders took over China or invaded China, he was humiliated, as was China, and he swore that someday he would help recover the country and that he would, you know, try to beat this other general who was always ready with his whip to move ahead. He wanted to be the first to show his patriotism and help to recover the country from foreign domination.
So that was like Egan, that's who it was, Charles Egan.
Yes.
Who said Judea.
No.
The whip of Zudi is what he called it.
Yeah.
I thought you were saying Jewish, like in the
oh, no.
race.
Sorry, Jew's whip. It's Z-U.
That's what it sounds like. I know, it sounds like Jew, you know.
Jews, because it has apostrophe
Judeo-S. Whip, oh. You know.
He read it as Jew's whip, but yeah.
But it'd be different Mandarin versus Cantonese, and that's the difference,
yeah,
because
right? In Cantonese it would be General Judea, and he would say Judy.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
That's why it was sounded, you know, I was wondering what the...
Yeah, it's the same poem.
The same poem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. here we have... Now, is she positioned okay for an interview now? Okay, so we need to go up. Here, let me do it. Is that,
like
was that good?
Okay. How about that?
All right.
Is that okay, Michael?
But see, she wants to look at me. See,
yeah.
And this
so,
is what happens.
Okay. So I should move the chair.
Can I move it?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, if you think so.
Just, what do you think? Is that okay? Because she's going to be looking this way.
Okay. Is that all right?
If well, I talk? You don't have to go.
Okay.
That's not natural for you. That's
no.
what you're going to be doing.
Okay. I'm going to be doing this.
Is that okay? All right.
Mm-hmm.
So what gets me about... I think there was something about resistance in the last one that you read, the last poem.
Right. And the Jew's whip is an allusion to how you want to get ready to get back at the enemy and to reclaim. So Jew's whip is an indication that you want to be ever ready and you want to be the first to be able to accomplish that task.
And what does that symbolize?
I think it symbolizes the sense that, like the general who everyone, all, you know, the country knows in terms of being heroic and being anxious to right the wrong, that immigrants at Angel Island felt the same way, that there will come a day, even as this person is being deported, that they will be able to correct the wrong that's been committed against them.
I'm wondering, the whole show is called Exclusion and Resistance, and it was very important to all the scholars that that was exclusion and resistance. And in light of that, how does Angel Island and these writings fit within that theme?
There was very little recourse in terms of what the Chinese could do about the treatment at Angel Island because they were coming as immigrants. They had no legal rights, political rights. China was too weak to really defend them or to make sure that they weren't mistreated as citizens of China. So one of the few ways they had to respond or resist to the mistreatment that they sensed was to write these poems. I think in the early 1900s, this form of classical poetry was a common form of not cultural expression only, but expressions of resistance. And so they were able to vent their frustrations. They were able to express the sense of wrongdoing that they felt had been committed against them through these poems that they wrote and carved into the walls. And they, if you read some of the poems, it also says this is a record of what happened to us. It's also a way for us to tell those who will be following us what to expect and to console them and to encourage and support them, because we know what they're going to have to go through too. And I wonder if it isn't also a record of resistance for future generations, especially if they bothered to carve them into the walls and not just penned or pencil them in, that they must have also thought about how this would be read by others, not only who followed them as immigrants, but future generations.
How did they actually carve it?
Well, they would brush the characters onto the wall, and then they would use probably a penknife of sorts and carve around the brush strokes into, and the wood was quite soft on the walls so that they could use a penknife and be able to carve into. And it probably took some time to do that. But the poems are all in classical poetic form and with what appears to be like brush calligraphy, and the outlines of the brush strokes is what you see even today. If you were to go to the immigration station, it's still visible even through these years because they carved it that deeply. And even as coats of paint have been painted over, you could still see traces of the poems, and there's a few that are quite visible. And the upstairs, for example, you could just see characters, rows and rows of characters along every single wall wherever the hand could reach.
I thumped. Did you hear that? Do you remember where it was? My foot. I gotta take my shoes off. I got these big clogs on and I thumped. Do you remember where it was? Okay, can you just tell me just the very beginning of what you said, where you said they start off with the brush strokes and then use the penknife, that much?
Okay, the way they did it was that they would use a Chinese brush and brush the characters of the poems onto the wall, and then they would probably use a small penknife of sorts and carved around the outline of the brush strokes deeply into the wood, which was quite soft, so that even today you can see the impressions of where the characters were carved into the wall.
I'm wondering, you teach young people or have taught young people throughout a good career here. Mm-hmm. When you have taught this history to young people and you talk about the writings, what kind of response do you get from them?
I think I teach college, so they're not quite that young, but the college age students that I teach, they're usually quite surprised that Chinese would write poetry. And what, you know, when we're looking at this period of immigration history, we're talking about Chinese laborers coming to this country. And the assumption has always been, well, they're probably not highly educated and maybe probably not even literate. And so they're surprised, one, that they would write classical poetry. And two is that I think they're very surprised at the sentiments and the strong feelings, emotional feelings as well as strong feelings of anger and feelings of revenge that come through the poems as well. So I think it's both, they're surprised at the literary quality of the poems and that they chose to express themselves using poetry, and then secondly at the sentiments and the strong feelings of revenge and anger that's expressed through the poems too. And so they're kind of in awe that, you know, this could have been written by Chinese laborers and that these poems have been recorded and have been translated and kept for posterity. And I think even more so when I take my students to Angel Island and they actually see the poems on the walls, they're just totally flabbergasted, I think is the word for it. And also, you know, kind of in awe and kind of inspired that these immigrants could have written these poems.
Are there any contemporary comparisons to these writings?
In America, by Chinese in particular?
Oh, no, by anybody.
Well, it's interesting.
I mean, what situations would it be in comparison to?
Oh, you mean in terms of American history, contemporary American history? I can't think of anything off my head to me.
I mean, it's not the same as graffiti.
No.
But what about any prisoners or, I don't know if there are any types of writings, you know, by people incarcerated or...
A few years ago, there was an exhibit at the New York Chinatown Museum of the Americas, and it was cultural and artistic expressions of detention and confinement by Chinese from the province of Fujian who had come into the United States, been smuggled into this country and were caught and had, this is the Golden Venture ship that was capsized in New York Harbor. And I believe it was 1999. Yeah. And so the Fujianese immigrants, or Fujianese undocumented aliens who were caught and detained for over a year, actually they wrote poems and did artwork while they were waiting to be released. And their poems were similar in terms of expressions, but also in terms of the same sentiments about being detained and confined. And those poems were on exhibit, and they haven't been published, but I think collections have been put together and translated in a similar way that we did with the Angel Island poems. So there have been other immigrants who've come from China in recent years who have used that same form of poetry. Probably not the same classical style that was prevalent in the 1920s and 30s during the Angel Island period, and probably more more free verse kind of Chinese poetry, I believe, than then. And recently there was the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation had a annual event, fundraising event, and they invited young Asian American rap poets to create as well as to recite their poems about what Angel Island meant to them. So they were trying to contemporize and also have younger people express themselves and how they relate to this history. So I guess there's been other spin-offs, is what I'm saying, using poetry as a form of expression.
You don't know if they recorded that, do you?
I think they did. Okay. Felicia Lowe would have them. Okay. Or the Angel Island Immigration Station. And Jenny Lim has done her own interpretations of the Angel Island experience using poetry.
Why are these writings an act of resistance?
I think because of what's expressed in the poems, they are ways that the Chinese could vent their frustrations, express their anger, express how they feel that they've been wronged, and how they hope someday to seek revenge and to right the wrong. I think that that is one of the few ways that they could respond and show that they didn't think this was right, what was happening at Angel Island to them and the treatment that they were getting, the way that they were being treated. So this is one of the few ways that they could express that, even though they couldn't act on it. It's one of the few evidences that we have of the early Chinese immigrants and what they thought about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the way that they were incarcerated at Angel Island Immigration Station. So in that sense, I see it as resistance. I think writing can be a form of resistance when you can't act upon it politically or physically in any other way.
Let's talk about, you know, the lengthy stays. Can you give an example of how long people were there and what kind of living conditions?
Well, when Chinese immigrants arrived in San Francisco, they were transferred to a boat and taken to Angel Island if they were not, if their papers were not in order to prove that they had a legal right to enter the country. And during the exclusion period, only those who were of merchant class and those who were U.S. citizens or those who could prove that they were students or diplomats or students, everyone else would have to go be ferried over to Angel Island and kept at the immigration station, locked up actually in barracks where the women and men were separated. And the average stay at Angel Island would be 2 to 3 weeks. That would be the average stay. What you're doing is you're waiting for your turn to be called in for interrogation to see if you could prove that you are who you say you are and that you're one of the exempt classes of immigrants that can be allowed in because of the Chinese Exclusion Act. So the stays were usually about 2 to 3 weeks. And basically, it's like being in jail because you're locked in and you're only allowed to go out of the room to the dining hall for your meals 3 times a day when they call you. And aside from that, there was an exercise yard that was attached to the men's barracks. And during the daytime, that door would be open. You could go out and get some exercise and play ball. But other than that, you are pretty much imprisoned. And people who did not pass the interrogation and could not prove to the immigration inspectors that they were truly of the exempt classes to come, would then have to hire an attorney to help them appeal their cases. And if that happened, they would be also imprisoned at Angel Island. And often those cases would go on, depending on how many appeals you need to go through and what the waiting periods were. Those people would have to stay a couple of months, and the longest that we know of a person being kept at Angel Island waiting for their appeals to be cleared would be 20 months. One woman that we interviewed said she had stayed at Angel Island for 20 months. So that would be a long period. Now, most of the poets who wrote these poems, we suspect, were the ones that were waiting for appeals to go through, and they were the most frustrated, and they had the most time, and they had the most frustrations and things to express through poetry, and they probably wrote the poems. So I think that once they go through the appeal process, only about 5% were deported in the end. Because in most cases, the higher courts believe that the process had been unfair and that the person should be allowed to be landed. But it's just the ordeal of going through this whole process. And so when we talk about long detentions and the fearful interrogation that people had to go through, this only happened to, most people went through within 2 or 3 weeks. And then the people going through the longer appeals, I would say less than a fourth of them would go through appeal and wait there for months. And then only 5% of them were actually deported in the end.
And there were suicides, too.
There were talks of suicide. People remembered people committing suicide, but we could not find any documented cases of suicide. But there's been stories that have been passed on how people were afraid to go. The women, for example, were afraid to go into the bathrooms because they had heard that people had hung themselves in the bathroom because they were just didn't want to be deported, didn't want to go back to China because they felt humiliated that they didn't make it through. And so there were reported cases of suicide. And one immigration inspector, one interpreter, actually was called in to help in a case where a woman had taken a chopstick, supposedly, and had rammed it through her ear and killed herself that way. But most people talked about hearing of cases of people hanging themselves in the bathrooms.
And I've seen those bathrooms, and they look pretty scary to me.
The ghosts haunt those bathrooms.
It feels like it's haunted to me. I didn't even know that story. You talked about the lengthy interrogation sessions. Can you give an example of what that is and what would it entail?
Well, because the Chinese Exclusion Act said no...
you need to push just a little... Well, don't hit it. But hit me.
Sorry, Michael.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this okay?
Okay. Because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, only certain classes of immigrants could come to the United States from China between 1882 and 1943. And immigration had no way of knowing who was coming in as a merchant or as a son or a wife of a U.S. citizen without putting them through some kind of interrogation or questioning. So the point, from the immigration department's point of view, it was if you really are who you said you were and you weren't a paper son, someone who had bought papers to and count coming in pose as a son or as a wife of a exempt class, then you should be able to answer these questions that pertain to your family history going back maybe three generations, or questions pertaining to the village and where you grew up and where you lived, or questions about your household and your knowledge of your father or your husband. So they would come up with these questions that they would ask the prospective immigrant, and then they would ask the same question. And these questions are like, who are your grandparents, and when did they die? Where are they buried? How many houses are there in your village? Who lives next door to you? How many windows are in your house? Which room that you sleep in? Which room that your father sleep in? Describe your wedding night. If you're, you know, really married to who you said you are, you should know those details. And so those kinds of questions were asked of the immigrant, and then they would ask the same questions of the sponsor, whether it's their husband or their father, whoever was going to be the witness. And the answers had to jive. They have to agree. And you should know these questions, and you should know the answers to these questions if you really are who you are. And the person who is related to you, who's bringing you to this country, should have the same answers.
So they would grill both the people who... I mean, basically, it's almost like a Law and Order episode.
Yes.
Where they get you in two separate cells and they're trying to get your story to be the same.
Right. It's a cross-examination, basically. And if you have disagreements on your answers, for example, someone said, we had a dog, and then the father said, we didn't have a dog. That's considered a major discrepancy. Or if you got dates wrong, way off. Or if you answered wrong about the village layout, which is something they thought everyone should know, that means in that one or two wrong answers could mean that you would be deportable. So it was really important that people prepare for these examinations and try to make sure that their answers would be in agreement. And even people who were true sons and true wives would fail the examination. Because if the other person remembered differently, or if you understood the question differently, a number of reasons why you might answer differently, then you could be deported. So people were really fearful of that interrogation, but they knew it was going to come, and they would have these coaching notes that they would memorize prior to even coming to this country, in able to prepare for these examinations. And the interrogation usually took one day, half a day or a day for the immigrant, and then they would spend as much time with the witness. And then if there are any discrepancies and they're not sure, they would call the immigrant back in for another interrogation and call the witness back. So this can go back and forth for three or four days before they make a decision on whether you've passed interrogation and you have proven that you are this person, you are related to this person, and that they'll then let you go on to San Francisco. That's why the stays were at least 2 weeks, if not 3 weeks, and sometimes even longer. And interrogations could go on between one day to three or four days.
It sounds similar to couples now.
Yes, that they suspect. Yeah.
Can you make that comparison?
I think immigration, if they suspect that you're coming in fraudulently as a wife, let's say today, let's say you're marrying for a green card, and they don't believe that you're going to stay together or that you're really married, they would do the same thing. And they say, well, if you're really married, then you should know these intimate details about one another and about the wedding night and so on. And they would ask questions of one person and then another person and see if their answers compared, were similar enough to prove that they really were married.
I wonder, since, you know, the post 9/11, how much more these kind of tactics are used.
Well, I think you think of it this way. Since 9/11, immigration has been moved into homeland security. And there have been raids into communities suspected of terrorists, harboring terrorists, or people who look like the enemy of the terrorists who are Middle Easterners or Muslims in particular would get targeted. And then they would be detained for long periods. They won't even have the right to any kind of legal counsel. And they would be deportable without any process practically. So actually it's gotten worse in some cases. And some of these people have been residing in this country. They're not new immigrants coming through like in the case of the Chinese. These are people who have been living, working, paying taxes. And because they look the way they do or they're suspected of, you know, participating, possibly being terrorists, they could be arrested and detained, interrogated, no legal rights, no legal representation, and then deported.
Were the Chinese the only ones who were interrogated?
The Chinese were the only ones that were targeted for this kind of interrogation and for long detentions because of the Chinese Exclusion Act and because of the immigration process that had been set up to enforce the Chinese Exclusion Act. And only the Chinese were named for this treatment because of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
And also, how much was the Paper Sons a factor in this?
Well, immigration knew that there couldn't be that many real sons born to as many Chinese women who were in the United States, and that Chinese immigrants couldn't have possibly gone back that often to sire that many children. I mean, they knew that the statistically it was impossible for that many to claim citizenship rights or relationships to Chinese merchants in order to come into this country. And so this whole process was set up to entrap Chinese, to catch them at coming in fraudulently as paper sons. The Chinese knew this, immigration department knew this, and it was a game of wits. But this was the process that immigration department devised, and they felt this was the only way that they could be able to determine whether a person who was coming in was truly a legitimate immigrant or not.
And let's discuss why or how Paper Sons came to be.
Well, after the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed and the Chinese realized that only exempt classes could come into this country, they devised a way of buying and selling identities and immigration papers so that those who were of the merchant class who had the right to bring their wives and children to this country would claim that they had more children than they did, and then they would sell these slots or identities to other fellow villagers so that they can come pose as sons and daughters of the merchant class. And then in 1906, the earthquake destroyed all the birth certificates, birth records at City Hall in San Francisco. And anyone who stepped forward and claimed that they were U.S. citizens, either born, naturalized, or through derivative means, would be believed. And they could then also report that not only were they a U.S. citizen, but they had four sons in China, which then created four slots by which they could sell these slots to others in China and enable four more people to come as immigrants, as sons of U.S. citizens, and be able to come into the country during the exclusion period.
There must have been a lot of fear to go back to China because the possibility of coming back would be in jeopardy.
Not too much, because immigration set up a process. You report that you're going to go back to China. You have a special certificate of identity saying who you are with your picture on it. And then when you come back, they make sure it's the same person as that, you know, the picture matches and that you're the same person. But in 1888, the Scott Act was passed. And that said, even those who had these certificates could not come back into the country. And there were about 20,000 Chinese who had left the country and who could not come back because of the Scott Act. So I think that experience always made the Chinese feel a little bit more nervous about going back to China for a visit because they weren't sure what might happen in the interval so that they might have difficulties coming back.
Why the Chinese?
I think 1882, when the Exclusion Act was passed, the Chinese was the first large group of Asian immigrants to this country. They were coming in large numbers. They were seen as a political as well as a cultural threat and liability. There, when the Depression hit in the 1870s, Chinese laborers were seen as unfair competition, unwanted labor. So the labor unions and white workers organized to find a way to keep the Chinese out, not only out of the labor market, but out of the country. So they pushed the Chinese Exclusion Act through with the help of opportunistic politicians who all ran on political platforms that the Chinese must go. And they were able to push through the Exclusion Act against the Chinese in particular, because they were seen at this time as being the threat, as being the unwanted laborer in California as well as in the West, in the Western states. So that's why the Chinese, and it's the only time, the first and only time, that a group was targeted for exclusion, not just restriction, but exclusion from coming to this country on a basis of national origin, on a basis of race and ethnicity. And the Chinese have that dubious honor of being the group that was targeted. And so it's a combination of historical political forces at the time that the Chinese were the group that was targeted for exclusion. And since then, if you look at immigration restrictive policies, they all build on the Chinese Exclusion Act, but they never again name a group by race or national origin. It's the Gentleman's Agreement, or it's the Immigration Act of 1924, or it's the Bar Zone Act that was really to keep Indians out of this country, or the Tidings of McDuffie Act, which was to keep the Filipinos out. But the beginnings of exclusionary and restrictive immigration policies in the whole United States and the whole U.S. history started with pushing the Chinese and making sure they weren't, they won't continue coming to this country.
You talked about the depression of the 1870s in China.
No, 1870 depressions. I meant it was the depression in the United States.
Oh.
And that was what led to the anti-Chinese movement. It was after the railroad had been built, after the Civil War is over, and the economic depression that was first plagued the industrial east of the United States finally hit the West. And so in 1870s, it's the beginning of anti-Chinese, not only anti-Chinese sentiment, but anti-Chinese violence, and then anti-Chinese laws culminating in the Exclusion Act of 1882 against the Chinese.
Wow, I didn't know there was an 1870s depression.
Yeah.
So what were the conditions in China at this time?
Yeah, I think...
Let's talk about the time of Angel Island.
Okay, during the exclusion period.
Yes.
Okay. And the Chinese still wanted to come even after the Exclusion Act was passed in 1882 because conditions in China were not getting any better. There had been political upheavals with not only foreign intrusion in terms of the Western powers trying to colonize China, but there were also local rebellions by peasants and political groups in China. The Opium War against Britain, where China lost, meant that there were serious indemnities that were that China was fined with, and that they had to give extraterritorial rights to Britain and later to Germany, Russia, U.S., Japan, other countries also that demanded not only fair trade or set up treaties where they could trade with more than just the few ports that were open for trade in the middle 1800s. So what I'm saying is that the presence of foreign powers, the Opium War, and then the Taiping Rebellion and the Red Turban Rebellions by peasants leading on to the Boxer Rebellion. There was warfare. There was local conflicts. There were, and then the indemnities that meant that there was a drainage of silver that was used to pay for the indemnities, and the coming in of manufactured goods that competed with local cottage industries, and China trying to industrialize at the same time, create all kinds of economic dislocations where the farmers and the peasant class ended up being displaced, losing their lands, becoming unemployed. So there was political unrest, there was economic instability, and on top of that, the natural disasters that constantly were always there. All these combinations, I think, led to poverty conditions and the Cantonese Guangdong area being so close to the coast and also being an area where they've been in contact with traders and with foreigners who have come into the area. And that's also the part of China where people have gone out to sea and gone elsewhere to seek a better livelihood, to try to support their families by finding work elsewhere. So the conditions in China, these conditions, continued into the 1900s. If the even after the Chinese Republic was established in 1911 with the 1911 Revolution, it still did not help matters because then you had internal civil war, you had warlords, you had political factions fighting for control of China. It wasn't until 1949 where the civil wars were finally ended and the People's Republic of China, Communist China, was established. But prior to this, we're talking about before 1949, where people in Guangdong province really felt that the conditions were so bad, they had to find a way to go elsewhere to find to make a better living. And that's why, and at that time, there was still recruiters. I mean, even in the early 1900s, there were jobs still available, even during the exclusion period. And at the same time, once you have people immigrating from one country and settling in another country, this idea of chain migration, where they would try to find ways to bring their family and their relatives and people from their villages who wanted to leave, they would help them find a way to come to America, get established, find work, and so on. So it's both push and pull factors, you know, during this period that help us understand why people would still want to leave China and come to America where they were unwelcomed because of the Exclusion Act, and how they were able to come because there were people here that were going to help them come and find work.
I'm curious about the definition of the word in Chinese of coolie.
Coolie, the two characters mean bitter strength. And we think of coolies, as, of course, from the coolie trade. And the coolie trade also included Asian Indians as well as Chinese. And so coolie is both an Indian term. It's really a Tamil term, an Indian term. And for Chinese, they took that Indian term and made it into a compound term, bitter strength. And everyone knows in China, and then it's the same connotation anywhere else in the world and certainly in the United States, that coolie meant cheap labor. It meant you're a beast of burden. And you're mainly used, you know, to do hard labor. And so, but coolie trade was never allowed in the United States. But in China, the coolie trade period where Chinese men were either recruited or coerced into becoming contract laborers or coolie labor and then sent to Peru mainly and to Cuba and to the West Indies to work on the plantations under very harsh conditions. I think with the contract were like for 8 years of hard labor before you were freed from your contract. And by then, many of them, because of the abuse they suffered, they committed suicide or they didn't live long enough to be freed. But that never happened in China. Most Chinese coming, particularly during the exclusion period, came as credit ticket, under the credit ticket system, where they borrowed money and had to pay back with credit once they were able to come, get a job, and get wages. But they were not slave labor. They certainly were not treated in the United States as the coolies were treated in Peru and in Cuba, where they had no rights and where there was no way of making sure that they were not being mistreated.
Let's get the definition clear between mm-hmm. coolie labor mm-hmm. and coolie trade.
Okay, coolie labor, meaning that, you know, you're being hired as a menial laborer usually, and you're going to do hard labor, but you're still being paid with wages. Coolie trade would be from 1850s to about 1870s, when Asian Indians and Chinese in particular were coerced or recruited into signing contracts where they had to work under contract conditions for a certain period of time and for very little wages. And similar to a slave, they would be guaranteed food, housing, and some clothing, and then they would have to work off the contract. Their passage would be paid, and they would have to work off the contract for a certain number of years. So there was coolie trade involved, where there were ships that were for the express purpose of finding cheap labor and bringing them on ships and coercing them to signing these contracts where they would work under slave-like conditions on plantations mainly for a certain duration of time. And that sense of coolie trade was outlawed internationally in the 1870s. And that's why it's only the period between 1850s and 1870s that was rampant.
But that was the railroads, wasn't it?
No, because the railroads was contract laborers, but not coolie trade. It's different because U.S. did not allow the U.S. except for ships. The government did not participate in the coolie trade. They would not allow any laborers to be coerced into signing contracts and to be treated as slaves or semi-slaves under those kinds of working conditions in the United States. So there's a difference between the coolie trade in terms of what happened to the Chinese and Indians in South America and contract laborers, who would be those who agree to.
It's almost like a technicality.
There's credit ticket and there's coolie trade and there's contract laborers. And actually, contract laborers were outlawed in the United States somewhere in the late 1800s. So you couldn't say that you're coming under these terms of being a laborer by contract, and you have to work off your contract in so many years. So that was not possible in the United States. So that's why I think it's easier for us to think about Chinese coming as credit ticket, on the credit ticket, borrowing money and coming in and paying it back with interest from their wages.
But it was awfully hard to do that, too. It took a long time for a lot of them, didn't it?
Years, yeah. I would say probably. My father actually came as a credit ticket person, and it took him about 10 years to finally pay back all that he owed for passage. And for the papers he had to buy as a paper son.
Can you talk a little bit about your father's experience? Because I know you are a descendant mm-hmm. of, I mean, he was a detainee.
Right. My father immigrated to America in 1921, and he was 15 years old at the time. The way he came was that his uncle in the United States was able to buy papers that said he was the son of a merchant in Stockton by the name of Young Ung. So my father, whose name was Tom Yip Jing, his surname is Tom, came to the United States claiming to be Young Hing's son, the second son of this merchant in Stockton. He had a coaching book. The papers that were bought for him by his uncle cost $1,500, $100 for each year of age. So his paper saying that he was a 15-year-old son cost his uncle $1,500, which my father knew he had to pay back. Then there was the passage paying for I think it was something like $85 to come to pay for the ship ticket. But then there's other costs involved in preparing for the trip and so on. And so he had this debt already when he arrived at Angel Island. He was detained at Angel Island for 2 months. Part of the reason was there was a backlog, and he had to wait for his turn to be interrogated. And then he went through the interrogation. He was asked about 100 questions, and his brother, his paper brother, and his paper father were asked the same questions. He was only interrogated once, and then they compared their answers, and evidently things matched. And then he was allowed to leave Angel Island and go on to San Francisco. His paper said then that he was Yung Heng Sun, the son of a Chinese merchant, and that's why he was allowed into this country. He kept that identity of being Yung Heng Sun until the day he died. And so I am the daughter. My Chinese name is Tom Bik Fong. We use our real Chinese surname, but my birth certificate and everything else says that my name is Judy Yung. So I've kept that duplicity. And if you see my father's gravestone at the cemetery in San Bruno, California, it says, here lies Tom Yip Jing, his real name, Yung Heng Sun, his paper name. So he kept that. He never confessed during the 60s in order to adjust his status and reclaim his name. He was afraid of being deported. He had no relatives to send for from China. So he decided to keep his paper name. And I think to the day he died, he was always worried that he's going to be deported. So he told us never to tell anyone what our real surnames were and to never tell anyone that who my father really is and where he really is from. So we've kept that in the family, and I've kept that secret in my name. And I think many other descendants in similar situations have always felt this sense of secrecy, a sense of duplicity, a sense of being unwanted, and a sense that we are deportable. We're illegals in this country, even though we're born in this country. And we've, through the years, my father's paid taxes, and we've gotten our education and so on. But I think that that's one of the psychological scars and emotional stress that the whole Exclusion Act and the immigration process and the Angel Island experience have left on not only the people who went through that experience, but on their children and the families and the communities that they're part of.
Well, here you are, a professor emeritus, and you think you could be deported. I mean, am I just hearing you say that?
Well, I know I can't be deported, no, but my father drummed it into our heads.
What, can you say that again, your father?
I said, I know I'm born in this country. I know I have rights, and I'm a U.S. citizen. And I know they can't deport me, but it's just that my father always drummed this into our heads. He always made us, you know, feel very afraid of immigration and of white authorities because we're illegals, and we knew this. And so I think it's just this feeling of insecurity and illegitimacy that and duplicity that stays with us even though we know better.
Is that perpetual foreigner thing?
Yeah, it's the idea. And, you know, people still come up to me and say, where are you from? And they never accept the answer that you could possibly be from San Francisco or anywhere in the United States. And they say, where are you really from? Or why do you speak English so well? And one time I was in Washington, D.C., and I was talking to someone, and she turned around and says, well, I hope you enjoy our country. Like, I'm a foreigner. I think we all experience that because of the way we look. It doesn't matter how Americanized we appear or how we speak. It's that, you know, who is an American? How do we prove that we belong here?
A lot of stations, when I say I'm, you know, producing this Asian American history series, they say, well, you know, our listenership isn't, you know, I don't have any Asians. And my response is, well, duh, you know, there's an exclusionary law since time, you know, and there's only 4% of the population because, you know, of these exclusionary laws. What do you say to that?
Oh. It's so frustrating. I get that question so often. Yeah, I just want to remind people that a fourth of the world's population are Chinese or Indians. And why is it that United States, being a land of immigrants, have only, you know, 4% are, you know, looking at Chinese, why is it only that only 4% of 1/4 of the world's population would be reflected in the Chinese in the American population? And a lot has to do, of course, as we've been talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the horrendous kinds of laws that were passed to keep the Chinese out for 62 years.
I'm sorry, can you say that again? A lot has to do with and leave out the as we've been talking.
Oh, what did I say?
Well, just say, you know.
Oh, the reason why there's such a small percentage of Chinese in the American population, considering that 1/4 of the world's population is Chinese, is that the American laws have been passed, and for 62 years, the Exclusion Act kept the Chinese out of this country. And it wasn't until 1965 Act was passed that Chinese immigration was put on an equal footing as from any other country, and 20,000 a year were allowed into this country, and that those who were family members of Chinese in America were able to come as non-quotas, that you see even increase immigration, so that today, in the last 30 years, more than half the population of immigrants coming to America are from either Latin American countries or from Asian countries, including China. So we see this explosion of Chinese immigrants now entering the United States in larger numbers. But we have to remember that the percentage of Chinese are small in the United States in the total population because of the Exclusion Acts that that succeeded in keeping the Chinese out of this country for so many years.
Very successful.
I would say so. I mean, I was looking at the statistics. The Exclusion Act was passed in 1882. In 1888, they allowed 10 immigrants from China into this country. So we really, and then until the Chinese figured a way to bypass the Exclusion Act with the paper sun process that they set up. Until then, the Exclusion Act was very successful in keeping out all Chinese.
And again, the paper suns is an act of
and the paper sun system coming in fraudulently as posed as exempt classes of Chinese according to the Exclusion Act was an act of resistance. It was an act of circumvention. Resistance can also be seen as finding ways to circumvent what are seen as discriminatory and unfair laws to the Chinese immigrants.
You have an interrogation scene in one of your books, I think.
Oh.
Do you recall that?
You mean in this book?
No, not in that.
Oh, in Unbound Voices.
Yes.
Yes, it's my mother's immigration file and the interrogation transcript.
That?
Yes. Well, one of the things about the Chinese Exclusion Act was that it created files and files of documents pertaining to the background and the interrogations, the transcripts of the interrogations with Chinese immigrants at Angel Island. And the reason why they kept all these files was that they had to recall files when new immigrants from the same family came through, so they would ask the same questions and see that there's a consistent pattern in terms of the responses about people's background and identities. So all of these files pertaining to the Chinese Exclusion Act cases and the Angel Island immigration cases are at the National Archives. The San Bruno, California National Archives branch has all of the Angel Island transcripts. So I was able to go there and find my mother and my father's immigration files and the transcripts of the interrogation. So I know what questions were asked of them. And when my mother came in 1940, my father was the witness, he being the husband sponsoring her to come. And so she was asked about 100 questions. He was asked the same 100 questions. And these interrogations were actually translated in English because they would ask questions in Chinese, of course, through an interpreter since immigrants didn't speak English. And then they would have to type the English answers in English into transcripts. So there are just many, in some cases I've looked at, my parents were considered an easy case because they were only asked about 100 questions. But there are other case files I've seen where the transcripts go on for hundreds of pages, and they're probably asked hundreds of questions accordingly in order to prove their right to enter. So In Unbound Voices, another book that I wrote, in the first chapter, I talk about the immigration process for my mother and how she, what preparation and costs were involved in doing the paperwork for her to come and join my father in 1940. And there I have the actual coaching book question and answers that she studied in preparation for the interrogation. Then I have the actual transcripts of what she was asked and what she said and what my father was asked and what he responded. And then I have an interview that I did with my mother afterwards to ask her about certain discrepancies I found in her story and in her interrogation papers. I mean, it just shows us how complicated and how expensive and how arduous this whole process was for everybody concerned. And I think what those immigration documents tell us is, you know, how people had to lie in order to circumvent that immigration exclusionary law to make it into this country.
Do you care if we use just a small section of that interrogation scene?
No, go ahead and just
to
have someone.
Yeah. It? Yeah. Have, I mean, we wouldn't be able to use very much of it, but I think it's really important to show kind of the innocuousness of the questions.
Yeah, and how hard it was for people to pass it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
Would you like to take a short break?